Welcome to Green Connections Radio, where we bring you insights on leadership, innovation, business, policy, and careers from top leaders whose work intersects with the energy and sustainability space. These leaders come from all sectors: government, business, academia, advocacy, the arts, and the media. Some are entrepreneurs and authors. I'm Joan Michelson. You benefit from my extensive network of C-level executives and transformers, and my many years in the media and Fortune 500 companies. We are in the midst of an energy revolution with massive and rapid innovation occurring in the space every day. One of the leaders of this energy revolution is the U.S. government in a bipartisan effort. President George W. Bush signed legislation to create the Advanced Research Projects Agency / Energy, known as ARPA-E, and that is the innovation arm of the Department of Energy. President Obama allocated about $90 billion to clean energy initiatives with the Recovery Act in 2009, and that included funding for ARPA-E to jumpstart America's ability to take a leading role and gain the economic advantages in this massive energy revolution. So what is the government's role in clean energy innovation? What can the government do in driving innovation without picking winners, if you will, which is, of course, not something the free market economy really likes. So the best person on the planet to talk to about the promising new energy technologies coming out of ARPA-E is Dr. Ellen Williams, the executive director of ARPA-E, and we are privileged to be here with her today in person at her offices at ARPA-E in Washington, D.C. Welcome to Green Connections Radio, Dr. Williams.
Well, thank you so much. It's such a pleasure to have the chance to talk to you today.
Oh, thank you so much. So ARPA-E's mission, according to the website, is to advance high-potential, high-impact energy technologies that are, in effect, too early for private sector investment. Take out the technical risk, right? A little bit about Dr. Williams is she's a chemical engineer who, interestingly, was chief scientist of British Petroleum, yes, BP, before coming to ARPA-E, yes, that BP that's responsible for the Deepwater Horizon oil spill 6 years ago. And in fact, I understand she was there at the time, and we can talk about that. Dr. Williams was also a senior advisor to the Secretary of Energy and served as a distinguished university professor in the physics department of University of Maryland here in the D.C. area, where she's been an active professor for many, many years. And she also has her own entrepreneurial spirit, having founded the University of Maryland's Materials Research, Science, and Engineering Center. Let's start off, Dr. Williams, with where is the energy revolution today? What are the trends?
Oh, the trends in the energy revolution are toward growing impact. In specific technology areas, I would say all across the energy spectrum. So we take a look at the energy spectrum in terms of transportation, in terms of energy efficiency and related resource efficiency, in terms of the electric power grid, and in terms of power, clean power generation. All of those different areas are seeing incredible advances. And I would say one of the new things that we're seeing is more and more the way that different parts of the energy system can work together and be coordinated to create bigger impacts than any one by itself can generate.
That's very interesting because it sounds like it's a bit of co-opetition, if you will, where you have competitors in one way, but they're partnering in another way. I mean, it's almost like PARC, the Palo Alto Research Center from Xerox, where they're now partnering with other technology companies and other companies. So how does that work? Are you talking about the companies that you guys invest in? You help form partnerships with them?
So the companies that we invest in actually a spectrum of performers. So about 40% of our performers actually come from universities, and about a third come from small businesses, and others from nonprofit organizations, federal laboratories, and so on. So we've got a whole spectrum of people who come into us and are given funding to try to develop clean energies. And that's one of the really exciting things for us, is that there is such an infrastructure of science and engineering expertise in the United States across all these different units, and very strong innovative and entrepreneurial spirit also. We really are drawing on that strength of the U.S. community in these areas. And then we bring together teams. University teams may pair with a large business. The university can bring in incredibly creative, cutting-edge ideas. The business brings in the know-how about what it takes to take a creative idea and turn it into something that is ready for uptake in the actual commercial sector.
Well, that begs the question. I've seen in some of the research that I did in preparing for this that companies like Raytheon and even Xerox have gotten some of the funding from ARPA-E. They don't really need the money. I mean, they have their own money. I would think that the whole point of ARPA-E is to give money to help stand up entrepreneurs who don't have any other access to resources, if you will. Why give money to a Raytheon?
The vast majority of our money, as I said, goes to university teams and small business teams. But we see a huge benefit, first of all, in bringing in the expertise from large companies. Often we have partnerships when we fund large companies. And the other part of our function is to invest in early stage research, research that is too risky for the private sector to invest in. And so if you go to a big company and you talk to the scientists and engineers, they will have phenomenal ideas, but they are too high risk for the company to invest in. They will not be funded by the company to do that research. So our requirement is that when we go into a project with anybody, we really make sure that this is too high risk, too early stage, that the private sector won't pick that up. And then we just carry it far enough to de-risk that technology. And then we start to look for the handoff partner. Who's going to pick this up and take it further?
Who owns the IP?
In all cases, the performer owns the IP.
So the performer being the recipient of the grant.
The recipient of the grant owns the IP. Again, this is part of our philosophy that entrepreneurship and innovation is a huge driver of creativity and advances in the clean energy sector.
Well, and if companies can't own the IP, there's no interest. It's one of the struggles with, and I've talked to Dr. Karina Edmonds about this at length and others, is the labs maintain ownership of the IP. And that's been a struggle with getting public partnerships with them. Where do you see energy sourcing coming from in, say, 10 or 20 years? Over your career, you've probably seen this kind of trajectory of sort of really low and then all of a sudden like spiking up like a hockey stick. So what's your vision for putting the climate accord aside perhaps, but let's say where will we be getting our energy from percentage-wise in 10, 20 years?
Well, so there's lots of different projections on that. If you go with a business as usual projection, it looks pretty grim, but fortunately the business as usual projection isn't what has to happen. And as technologists, we're here to change that projection. So the projected growth is going to depend on a combination of technical innovation and policy decisions. But we definitely need to see that the mix of clean energies has to increase rapidly, and we know it's possible for that to happen. So with the right continuing development of technology, plus a little bit of incentives for policy, we know that we can start to meet the goals of driving up the clean energy components, solar, wind, nuclear, hydro, and getting those up to the 25, 30, and so on percentage of our energy delivery that we have to reach.
25 or 30%, that's interesting.
Yeah.
I still believe that
that's not a prediction.
No, I understand, but I still believe that the fossil fuel company, there will be a role for it, and you need to.
Yeah.
And that we need to get them to clean up their act. I mean, it's really goofy, you know, what they're doing right now. So what are you really excited about? I mean, I've seen some technologies. One of the things that lights me up a little bit, pardon the pun here, is the street lighting, the smart lighting that gives internet access, and it alerts the police, and it gives all kinds, it collects data, basically.
Yeah.
It becomes a data center too, as well as an energy source, which is so multi-purpose, it's amazing.
Yeah.
But I mean, I'm an innovation freak. What really, you know, what lights you up? What's exciting to you?
So one of our projects that we're watching with bated breath, they're an alumni team. They finished up with us several years ago. It's called Makani. And the idea that they had was, right now, the amount of wind power we can generate is limited in a sense, because there's only certain parts of the country where the wind is strong enough and consistent enough.
I lived in North Dakota. I can vouch for that one.
But if you can go to higher elevations, the wind is steadier.
Really?
And stronger over a lot more of the United States. But you can't just build a wind tower 1,000 feet tall. I mean, it just becomes mechanically intractable. So their idea was, instead of building a physical tower, take the wind generator up on a small aero vehicle. And that sounds crazy.
Is it like a drone?
It's like a drone. It's an unattended air vehicle. And so the idea is that its propellers are going to do dual purpose. You fly your air vehicle up to the right elevation, and then you fly it in a circle, that matches the path of the tips of a wind turbine blade. As it's flying in a circle, the crosswinds then start to spin the propellers even faster, and you capture that extra energy and turn it into electricity.
So it's catching, in effect, the spin-off from the turbines rotating, not
right.
just the what the turbines are capturing, but
right.
the spin-off from it, too.
Well, it's not a perpetual motion machine.
Oh, okay, okay.
It's definitely not a perpetual motion machine. It's really capturing the wind energy that's flowing past those turbines. And so it's a tricky business because the propellers have to both control the motion of the UAV and
right.
catch the wind energy. So we funded this team to solve their aerodynamics questions of how do you fly a plane while at the same time capturing wind energy with it.
Hmm.
They did incredibly well. They put a demo up, flew it around, and practically the minute they landed on the ground, Google X purchased them and has been developing the technology ever since. And they're looking to go commercial in the next couple of years. So we're watching
cool.
that, and we're very excited because that could expand how much wind you can use in the United States. Plus, it's probably a very good technology for offshore wind.
That sounds like a longer conversation. So how do you address concerns that the government is picking winners? I mean, I know that there's a rigorous evaluation mm-hmm. process, and I know, as you said, you yeah. get them from various different sources.
Yeah.
But there are people who will say that it's the government picking winners. What's your, I'm sure you've had this question 100 million times, but
yeah.
what's your answer?
So our answer to that is that when we go into a program and put out a call for proposals, what we do is we set up the criteria that we want the program to meet. For instance, the criterion would be you will deliver solar energy at this level of efficiency, at this cost, and so on. And so we just set up the goals of the program. The project proposals come in, and we work very hard to select a portfolio of projects that span all sorts of different approaches to solving that problem.
Oh, so you're not picking a winner in terms of, you're not picking one technology to solve one problem. You're funding multiple ways to solve the same problem.
That's right. And then we expect that coming out of that, some of those ways will develop better and will really demonstrate their ability to move forward. And that happens during our projects. And then at the end, we work really hard with our teams to prepare them. We call it at month 37, what are you going to be doing? Because
right.
we fund them for 3 years. And at month 37, we prepare them to be going out and finding that next level of funding to continue to develop their technology.
Or hopefully looking for it before they leave.
Yeah.
So that begs the question, how do you allocate the funding in terms of technology mix? Obviously, there's wind, solar,
right.
data even,
yeah.
fusion, fuel cells,
yeah.
hydropower, microgrids.
Yeah.
How do you decide what the mix is?
Yeah. So that's also part of our portfolio. Because we are an innovation program, we're constantly changing our portfolio. So about a third of our programs end every year. We only fund a certain program for 3 years, then it ends. And so every year we're funding a third new programs. So that's our portfolio of different program topics, and we try to maintain a balance over time between the different areas of the energy sector, clean power generation, the activities of the electric grid and grid storage, energy efficiency, and transportation. So we're constantly changing that distribution so that overall we maintain a portfolio pretty much covers the entire energy sector. But the real reason, of course, that we're dynamic is that we're also changing our emphases to address new opportunities. So the types of programs that we would have funded 8 years ago are quite different from the types of programs that we're funding today. For instance, we're right now doing a competition called NextCar, and in that competition, we're asking teams to bring us ideas about how you could use the capabilities of vehicle automation to save energy.
Okay. Cool. So I spent years in the electric car division, so that speaks to me. One of the things that Green Connections focuses on a lot is advancing women. And you are highly unique because you've been a scientist in this space since way before it was popular. I would guess that you are one of the few women in your programs in school. What advice would you have for women who want to work in this space, who not necessarily college women, but even mid-career women who
yep.
might have to, because this is a fairly new space, and so they might need to be transitioning in
yes.
from another field and figuring out how their skills transfer. So what advice would you have for women who want to get into the clean energy economy?
Well, the generic advice is be confident. I talk to so many young women who are phenomenal, talented, outstanding, and they're worried that they're not good enough. They're good enough. They're really good enough. So number one is be confident. And number two is follow your dream. And number three is identify your strengths, your skill sets, and identify the skill sets that are needed, and just never let go on pushing your skills to their ultimate performance level and demonstrating what you can do.
Boy, that's a longer conversation too. What was it like being at BP during the oil spill?
It was hard. It was such a shocking event. The people in the company were devastated. Everybody wanted to jump in and try to help. And the situation was very confusing. It was really hard to know what was going on throughout most of the process. I was really fortunate. You mentioned Rita Colwell. I actually got pegged at that time to help BP set up its research institute, which it funded to look into the after effects of the oil spill.
And so So
I actually worked with Rita in the early days on that. And so it was great to be in a position where we were working on something to really try to be constructive out of such a very serious situation.
So what advice would you have for companies who want to increase their diversity numbers, especially in STEM fields, and even in the clean energy space? I mean, I've been to ARPA-E since its inception, and I gotta tell you, I'm frustrated because you can throw a bowling ball through the place and barely hit me or one of your fabulous women on your team. How do we do this? How do we get more women in? What do companies need to do? What does a good women's initiative look like, or something?
Yeah, it's really tough. I know that women are really highly incentivized by the importance of this topic and really want to work in this field. And so I would encourage women to follow their dream. And I think I would encourage companies to really emphasize that aspect of the motivation, why it is so important, and to recognize that a man and a woman may not talk and walk just the same way, but those differences don't necessarily mean that one or the other is better or worse, that those differences can really bring different perspectives and different capabilities into the room, and don't write one off in favor of the other.
And that's where innovation comes from, because you have different thoughts at the table.
You do.
That's where you get the diversity from. When you say emphasize what's important, do you mean, or emphasize that it's important, are you talking about that women make career choices based more on values?
I certainly know lots of women who are very value-driven in their choices about what they do. And so very often in our day-to-day work, we know why we're doing it in the back of our minds, but I think it's really good and important to bring it forward pretty often and remind ourselves, why are we doing this, how important it is, why it really matters to us.
Mm-hmm. And keep your eye on the end product, and a lot of people say, keep your eye on the why. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you, Dr. Williams. This has really been an extraordinary conversation, as I knew it would be. So what did you hear Dr. Williams say? Tell us maybe three words to describe the conversation to you. Post it to us on Twitter at Joan Michelson, or on our Facebook page, and you can like the page while you're there. Or write it to us in a review on iTunes when you subscribe. Thank you very much. Find us also on greenconnectionsradio.com, TuneIn, Stitcher, and iHeartRadio. I'm Joan Michelson. Thanks for joining us. See you next time.
Hi, my name is David Goldberg, president of Edge Studio, a voiceover company. We oversee professional narrators and voice actors for sales videos, training videos, telephone pre-recorded systems, commercials, web videos, and all applications requiring voiceover. And in fact, for over 20 years and in over 100 languages, we have been considered the most trusted and the friendliest leader in the voiceover industry. We're a green company with efforts toward sustainability at all of our studio locations. EdgeStudio.com. Sound people who are happy to help.